Ansarullah Political Bureau issued its first human rights document that was issued about a week ago about brutal crimes committed by the Saudi U.S. aggression against Yemeni civilians. We have, it was, by the way, entitled Yemen's Hiroshima. The report included 4,133 documented massacres and bombing incidents in residential areas with details regarding the time and the place of their occurrences. Saudi Arabia has been stacking war crimes in Yemen for the past 6 years. Will Mohammed bin Salman and maybe his generals ever be brought to justice over these horrendous crimes? Do we have a chance against these people?
I think it's doubtful, and this is because international law is at an all-time low, and it's really receding year by year. The only person that's going to get justice from the international law system or end up in The Hague will be some African dictator that was probably installed by a Western power to begin with. Those are the only people you ever see showing up in The Hague, more or less. But so the bottom line is that what Saudi Arabia has done is guaranteeing bad blood between the neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And so you can't erase that. This is going to sow the seeds for potentially future conflicts. There needs to be a unilateral withdrawal on the side of Saudi Arabia and a cessation of hostilities. This is the only way that we're going to avert more humanitarian disaster. Everything besides that is just really going to be a protracted, painful conflict, unfortunately. And well, we'll see if the West is going to come in like a knight on a white horse to try to, you know, broker some sort of negotiations, but or some roadmap to peace. But at the end, I think it's too late for that.
Well, it seems that Biden is a bit in hot water whether to back Mohammed bin Salman or not. Sometimes he gives him a good word, sometimes three bad words in a row. But at the same time, Yemeni civilians are losing their lives. They're losing their lives from bombs falling on their heads, Western-made bombs. They're losing their lives from the famine created by Saudi Arabia with the help of the West. And at the same time, if the West thinks really that they're going to try and do anything to stop this without the consent of the Yemeni people, those same Yemenis that are still in control of swaths of land of their country that have been able to liberate the occupied parts of their country, then they are really in on a wrong side here. They don't really understand Yemenis yet. I want to thank you very much, Patrick Henningsen, founder of the 21st Century Wire, for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will be next talking about the Lebanese crisis of economy. Stay with us.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
For the past 19 months, Lebanon has been reeling from a wrenching economic crisis. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was facing four extraordinary challenges: elevated public sector debt, a bankrupt banking sector, no economic growth, and the country was politically rudderless. Predicting how the crisis evolves from here is difficult. Lebanon's economic crisis, a tragedy in the making, in this following report. Lebanon's annual inflation rate reached a record high, and food prices soared by around 500% in February, highlighting the dramatic impact on consumers and businesses of the country's worst financial crisis in decades. With hindsight, Lebanon's economic crisis was predictable. By the time the crisis erupted in October 2019, the economy was already facing four extraordinary challenges. First, public sector debt had reached such elevated levels that a default had become a question of when, not if. Second, the banking sector, having lent three-quarters of deposits to the government, had become functionally bankrupt and increasingly illiquid. Third, the productive economy had experienced virtually no growth for an entire decade.
a development with acute socio-political implications. And finally, and perhaps most importantly, the country was politically aimless. There was no president between 2014 and 2016. There were multiple and lengthy delays in cabinet formation, and the 2018 parliamentary elections took place, but only after a five-year delay. The Hariri government that was in place when the crisis hit in 2019 became impotent to such an extent that it lacked power to deliver on any of the reforms required as a condition for foreign support. By October 2019, the citizenry had had enough. Sensing a looming crisis and frustrated by the utter lack of action by the political class, hundreds of thousands of people took to the streets demanding radical political change. The cabinet resigned, throwing the country into a political crisis. Unsurprisingly, capital inflows came to a sudden halt. Banks, already insolvent, experienced a sharp liquidity crunch, forcing them to declare a bank holiday and institute severe restrictions on bank withdrawals. A foreign exchange black market emerged, and the national currency, the lira, sharply depreciated. In return, inflation soared and people's real wages and purchasing power collapsed. In addition, as if all these woes aren't enough, a severe COVID-19 crisis hit the country, and most tragically, a devastating explosion took place on August 4, 2020, leveling a third of downtown Beirut. Human capital is fast eroding due to a massive brain drain of the young and skilled. Equally worrying is the loss of physical productive capacity resulting from widespread business closures. Much more alarming are the security consequences of the economic implosion. Lebanon's sectarian history is rife with conflict, and economic collapse provides a perfect habitat for a return of violence.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Nasri Harb, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Uzal University. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Nasri Harb. Now, left to its own devices, the Lebanese economy will for sure generate an alarming acceleration of youth and skilled labor emigration. We have a lot of enterprises closing. The currency is becoming further unanchored. Hyperinflation is wiping the incomes of the public and their wealth. And we have now food and medical shortages that seem will only escalate. Which requires more level of humanitarian support, foreign humanitarian support. That is the worst case scenario, and I thought that we were already there. Could this become even worse now?
Okay. Hi, Marwa. I think there is no limit to how bad we can go. Let me tell you this. As long as the government does not take any action, things will worsen. The hyperinflation will fuel itself. As a number, we can cite two recent examples from two economies. In Venezuela, for instance, where inflation has reached about 65,000%.
Wow.
That is a 71% inflation every month, which means that your salary that you receive at the beginning of the month will lose 70% of its value at the end of the month. So you are left with only 30%. Another typical example is, a famous example is Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe, in the peak of the hyperinflation, currency used to lose a 98%, which is almost its whole value every day at the peak of the inflation. So there is no limit to how bad we can go.
That is a scary thought right there.
Indeed.
But there is one best case scenario for Lebanon that's being discussed all around now, is by starting with a cabinet. That should be giving some sort of a short-term stabilization program for the country, which involves tightening of liquidity, maybe arresting the fiscal implosion, maybe inducing capital control, especially on large amounts of money which are still being leaked out of the country, and maybe obtaining an urgent external bridge loan like that of the IMF. However, look, I understand all these points that we are speaking about, but wouldn't even more loans by the Lebanese be a burden for them rather than an actual escape from this reality?
The loan from the IMF, you can say it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, from one side, it will call for more reform. It will help. And it will ask for discipline from the government. However, on the other hand, if there is no discipline, if the loan is not well negotiated, because the trend at the IMF is to follow more liberal action, reducing government size, and taking harsh action towards the harsh social action. So if it's not well negotiated, it may lead to further social problems.
You mean more privatization instead of actually putting help towards the public institutions?
Exactly. So it takes strong political action and a strong political negotiation to negotiate a good terms for these loans. That's one. Two, if this loan is not well used, it will add to the burden of the country, like the debt to the country, like similar to what happened to Paris conferences. We have received aids and billions of dollars, and after all, it came out like as a burden on the country.
And our debt becomes $120 billion.
Exactly.
But the annual inflation rate, Dr. Harbi, is that it reached a high record, and the food prices soared. They are more than 500% this February 2021, highlighting the dramatic impact on both consumers and enterprises as well, especially because this is the worst economic crisis for at least two decades. How much longer do you think these businesses can withstand such a dramatic impact on them?
It's difficult to say, but however, the conditions are very harsh. If we can cite what are the problems faced by the businesses, it's unbelievable. You have one, reduced demand. People are poorer than before. Difficult investment because there is no exchange. Unstable exchange rate. You can start with a given price, and then at the end of the day, the price will be changed. Uncertainty, okay? You can never tell what to expect in the next day. Unmotivated employees, which will reduce the cost of production. Mm-hmm. You have also angry consumer, which will be very difficult to deal with. You have difficult financial transaction. If you want to export, if you want to import, how can I afford the exchange rate, okay? The cost of changing price is by itself. Cost of changing price is huge. Mm-hmm. In some cases, in some supermarket, like during, I think, German hyperinflation, 50% of the employees' time was on only changing prices.
So it's very costly for the enterprise.
So just changing prices takes 50% of your resources. So
and the remaining 50% is now becoming a referee trying to stop people from killing one another. What are you saying represents a public call, Dr. Nasri, to all Lebanese decision makers, whether it is the prime minister designated one, the central bank governor, even the president of the republic as well? I personally do not see a glimmer of hope here. I'm a realist. But as an economist, what would be the first thing that you would do to try and salvage what is left of the economy in this country?
Okay. Well, we were speaking about that in a conference a few days ago. Mm-hmm. What it takes at the beginning, first of all, a political will. Okay. Once we have a political will, any action can help. It takes a multilateral plan. You have, first of all, of course, you have to have a sort of capital control. You have to and that's very important, to establish trust. So I would say trust, then trust, then trust. That's the first point. Capital control, restoration of banking sector, okay? And we can speak also about halting the money printing process, because this is the main cause of the inflation. Economical reforms and structural reforms. I can speak here about political reform and economical reform. We can give an example, a simple example, which will be a good start, is to rebuild the electrical system for electrical sector. Rebuild it, okay. And an important one is to encourage import substituting industries, mm-hmm. because this is one of the main source of fleeing our the currency.
You see, this is what we lack in Lebanon, Dr. Nasri. We should have someone like you to be Minister of Economy, and yet we are still fighting between one another which sect will get which ministry, which, by the way, puts me at a very depressed position as a Lebanese citizen, because I don't know whether tomorrow will be better or even 10 times worse. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri Harab, economist and dean of the Faculty of Management, Finance and Economics at Izal University. Thank you very much for being with us, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses, and then we'll be back. So stay with us.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful. We have sent down rain from the sky in a measured amount and settled it in the earth. And indeed, we are able to take it away.
Brothers and sisters, the verse under discussion was the 18th verse. وَأَنْزَلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً بِقَدَرٍ فَأَسْكَنَّاهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ. And we sent down water from the sky in measure, and we launched it in the earth. وَإِنَّا عَلَى ذَهَابٍ بِهِ لَقَادِرُونَ. And verily, we are able to take it away. With regard to first part of the verse, we understood that Almighty Allah is equally able to grant and remove His blessings. This proves He has total control over the earth, over the creations, and the very same meaning of the previous verse, وَمَا كُنَّا عَنِ الْخَلْقِ غَافِلِينَ. He sends blessings, but in qadr, in a measured way. And He is also aware that He should save it and lodge it in the earth. We know that the outward crust of the earth consists of two layers, the permeable and the impermeable. If all of the earth's crust were permeable, water from rains, even from the long-continued rains, would immediately seep into the depths of the earth and everywhere would remain dry. The entire crust were impermeable, like mud or clay, all the water and all the rainings would remain on the surface of the earth and could become contaminated and could actually spoil, could become malodorous, becoming a source of death and sickness instead of being a source of life. However, the great and beneficent Allah has made the upper layer permeable and the lower layer impermeable. So the water can go deep into the earth and can be contained by the impermeable layer. Later, the water, unpolluted and pure, would become available as springs, as wells, as subterranean canals. But this is also biqadr. This is, in a measured way, the refreshing and wholesome water we obtain from deep wells and consume is possibly the result of rains that had fallen many years ago and had been saved underground without pollution for today's use. وَأَنْزَلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ مَاءً بِقَدَرٍ, and we sent down water from the skies in measured way. فَأَسْكَنَّاهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ, we lodged it in the earth, maybe for the future human beings. However, he who has created man to live on this earth and has simply made water the most important element for his survival has also created many important means to collect and safeguard it even before the appearance of man. Some of these reserves of water are on high mountains in the form of snow and ice. Every year, they melt and flow down as streams and rivers. Sometimes they remain for hundreds and thousands of years on the mountains till the commandment for them to descend is issued, so they will start to melt down, irrigating the dry lands.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In
this
series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
To listeners, one more interesting point remains to be mentioned. The word fi, وَأَسْكَنَّاهُ فِي الْأَرْضِ, we lodged it in the earth, in this Quranic phrase, points to the possibility that the verse indicates underground sources of water, not sources that are above the ground. This is one other possibility of the meaning when we have a closer look at the word fi, wa askannahu في الأرض. Anyway, you can see that proving the power of Allah over the creation was started from mentioning different levels of human perfection, and it continued up to here, creation of the heavens, creation of the skies, and now sending down water, and when He wills, He will take it back. This equal power of sending and getting it back, as was mentioned earlier, is here to tell us that we should not consider that the blessings of Allah are here at our hand and within our reach forever. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when fit begins.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha, the Khutbatul Muttaqin or the Khutbatul Hammam. And we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about a very important quality of the pious people, and that is وَلَا يَخْرُجُوا مِنَ الْحَقِّ, that the pious person never exits the truth. And the criterion for the truth is to base a person's actions based on a divine intention, and also the actions should be based on divine commandments. That is the criterion, the main criterion for truth. And of course, there are other different things that have that are deeper here that, of course, we don't have the knowledge to be able to discuss myself, and we need guidance from higher people about the reality of the truth. You know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran mentions about the truth in a very advanced and intricate manner, where he talks about the fact that Allah makes sure that every entity is able to have an understanding of the truth.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about the truth, he talks about it in a very intricate manner, and he says that definitely we will show our signs to them in the horizons and in their own souls until they will know the truth. حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ. They will realize that God is the truth. That means these signs will come within yourself, inside your heart, in different situations. You will realize that Allah will show you that He is the only truth, and He is the basis of the whole of existence, and He is the true reality. But the way towards that is when a person follows the commandments of God. That is where God is there. If a person wants to see God, he wants to see the truth, the path towards seeing the truth is through the right actions and avoiding the wrong actions. That's where a person will be able to see the truth. Anyways, inshallah, that was the previous part. Today, inshallah, we'll discuss another section where Imam Ali alayhi salam says that in samat lam yaghummuhu samduh wa in dhahik lam ya'alu sawtuh, that a pious person is one who, when he is silent, لَمْ يَغُمُّهُ صَمْتُهُ, that a pious person is such that when he is silent, his silence doesn't make him sad. Now the question here would be that why would a person be sad by remaining silent? Of course, this is when a person is probably referring to the fact that when a person makes an error or is silent in a place where he is not supposed to be silent. You see, when a person is silent when he is supposed to be speaking and doing something that is important, and speaking, let's say, for the truth and in support of the oppressed people, and he remains silent at that point, definitely that sadness, that type of silence will make him sad, because he knows that if I would have spoken the truth at that time, then I would have helped a poor person, I would have helped the oppressed people of the world or oppressed person in the society. But a pious person, because of his adherence to the commandments of God, is so firm in what he speaks and what he is silent about that such a situation doesn't occur.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we say that a pious person is one whose silence doesn't make him sad, meaning that his silence also is based on certain defined principles, and he has control over how he speaks and how he controls himself and what he doesn't speak. it is such that this control that he has over himself, over what he speaks and what he doesn't speak, gives him that opportunity and gives him that special privilege to be in a state of happiness when he is silent. You will notice that many a times in our lives we'll have come across that if we look at our lives properly, we'll see that we were silent in some areas whereby if we would have spoken a word, we would have changed a very big thing in the society, a very important thing in the society. These experiences everyone must have in their lives, whereby they would have helped one who is being slandered. They would have supported one who is being destroyed, whose respect is being destroyed. At times you hear your friend or a person backbiting another person, and we remain silent. This type of silence is a wrong form of silence. This form of silence is something that is destructive, something that is, you can say, that reduces progress, that is regressive. And a pious person has got, because of that control and that understanding that he has of the society, of the situation, of when to speak, when not to speak, he has this ability to be able to be silent at the right time. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he gives us the opportunity to be able to adhere to this particular commandment and this particular quality that Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned regarding the people who are pious. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Coffey, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, also known as warriors, Julius Urile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Urile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gun Runners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so I, you know, you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film that would I would have maybe, you know, it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gun Runners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context. So that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. His little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing, I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely
camps,
breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya. Over to the skyscrapers of New York, you could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes, and really is very much the superstar, the very talented runner, and so on. And his mate, Matanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
But Lee, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lorupe Peace Race. Tekla Lorupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Aurelia Matanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really? And can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Matanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. And of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive, is now being applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was, he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand with their ability to be good athletes. Yeah. And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Matanda he's talking. He's like, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underline is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country. It's something we probably all need to look at in, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, impose yourself. And I think actually, they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
When I was in the bush, I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. When the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you, and then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Aurelia. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Aurelia's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different, so you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, draw people in. Aurelia is much more kind of, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, you know, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, you know, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out from in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that is that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people, and so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, you know, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that, many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
He really does need to make a breakthrough. And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting in Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it and stuff. So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages, and actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. So it's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletics industry, is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
So it's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world. Mm.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعرض غير ديني محمد اللي هديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. With me,